it. Stockton Tennant's verbal highs. Let's start the show with Lewis Tennant. Here we go. Guests and interviews that you're looking for, with creators, innovators, and so much more. For all episodes and further info, verbalhighs.com is the place to go.
All right, welcome to Dr. Tennant's Verbal Highs, a podcast podcasted from a kitchen bench in Kingsland, which in this instance is in Auckland, which in every instance I think is in New Zealand. Although I have a nagging feeling I'm going to have to Google that straight afterwards and see if I am in fact in the only Auckland on the planet. Oh goodness, I will keep the intro brief today. My right side of my jaw has swollen up a la Quagmire from Family Guy, and I've got a bad feeling it's my teeth, and I've got a bad feeling I should have gone to the dentist a few years ago. But I won't drag the rest of you down with that, but I will cut to the chase as quickly as I can. Two things today on the show, one being a guest as per usual. My guests, if you're new here, chat to me for around 80 minutes, the idea being open conversational style, little or no editing, generally the latter. But also I want to play you some more of my student's work, being that I tutor audio type things up the road, and I started or took over a podcast making course essentially this semester, and I thought the work was so good I asked a few students if I could play theirs, and they've graciously agreed. But firstly, I'll chat quickly about my guest, Ian McGann. What a coup. Thank you, Ian. Thank you so much for coming in. It was a great feeling talking to someone who's a pioneer of New Zealand radio, in that him and a team of likely fellows in the 1960s birthed Radio Hodaki, a story in New Zealand's history that's not just about changing the course of broadcasting, but about kind of sticking it to the man and public opinion changing official and governmental opinion laws. There's a lot online about that. There's also a lot that Ian chats about around that, the Hodaki story. Ian also has been a major force in concert promoting in New Zealand for the decades since he wound up at Hodaki. And he started off touring none other than John Clarke, of course known to New Zealanders those days mainly as Fred Dagg. But that led to a slew of international artists, including Pavarotti, multiple tours with AC/DC, that one tour when Michael Jackson came here in 96 that I saw and didn't realise would never happen again. Who else? Instrumental in Split Enz and the Finn Brothers having a touring career. You bloody name dropper. Did I say Dire Straits? Dire Straits. A bunch of other acts, a large amount of other acts as well. And I thought about when I was doing this, you know, what goes on tour stays on tour. How many stories will such a professional have? And I certainly didn't get all of them by any means. But the ones I got were great. Although I'm sure the ones I didn't hear were even better. Jokes. Thank you, Ian, for coming on. And I was hoping he'd say that Michael taught him to moonwalk or something. But as you can imagine, Michael stuck to himself, which you'll hear about in the podcast. Also talks about his long-running friendship with Billy Connolly, which started off in the business realm in terms of a phone ringing and someone saying, I'm doing Billy Connolly in Australia. I think this was in the 70s. Do you want to do him in New Zealand? Ian said yes, which he talks about. It led to a great friendship, which still endures, and having toured Billy. This is not individual shows. This is coming into New Zealand and leaving, having toured him 15 times since. And I take the opportunity to talk about what a fantastic human being I think Billy Connolly is. He's up there in my holy grail people. And I think, you know, Billy is a great metaphor to me for, you know, how we should be treating each other, especially in this world of kind of combative online communication and batshit crazy global leadership. So it was really lovely to sort of have a vicarious friendship for a moment through Ian. Like the show? Oh, no, we won't do that. We won't do that. We'll talk firstly about... So what I'm going to play up next is the third of my student exemplars. This is from Jack, and he put a piece together which speaks to something I say to all audio students and students putting together anything creative, which often, you know, less is more. Think about the great dub music and so on. So Jack's done a piece about a friend of his chatting about his music that he makes and his life around that. And you'll see what I mean about less is more as it goes. It's just beautifully produced, very sonically appealing, quite powerful in how he lays out the guy chatting. But it isn't 8,032 sound effects and four different pieces of music and six people chatting and so on. Lovely work, Jack. Now we're at the promo bit. Like the show, Verbal Highs Podcast on Facebook, Verbal Highs on Twitter. You can go to my website, verbalhighs.com, and subscribe to iTunes or other podcast feed services.
Verbal Highs, straight down from up above.
I'm Shingy. I'm Munch. And together, we're 1174. The artist formerly known as Two on Point. I don't sleep with, like, the curtains. Like, they're never closed. I 100% feel you on that. Like, you leave the curtains open. It's a natural alarm clock, you know? It's like, you hear the sound of the birds. You feel the heat from the sun going through your window. If there's a breeze, it hits your face. Yeah, it's the little things. You wake up and you see outside it might be raining, but that's what you have to plan your day around, you know? It's not forced. Whenever you get up, you know? And that's like kind of what we do with our music too. Like, nothing's ever forced. I'm not always trying to be that dude who's writing songs every single day, trying to spend his entire day being inspired, like, because then you overwork the muscle, you know? Skating. You gotta do it before 10 when you get that fresh morning air. You got the park to yourself. You can hear the sound of the wheels on the concrete. Pop a trick. Just like, and it hits on the beat of the soundtrack that you're playing. It's like when you listen to a soundtrack when you're skating, you're focused on skating. It's kind of like background music. And when you're making music, it's kind of like you're so focused on the music, so to be able to skate and listen to it, it takes me back to being a consumer, you know? And I can hear the song for its natural qualities and what it genuinely is, you know? Yeah, what it inspires organically. It's a good time to have things come to you without forcing it. For us, it's like the process is never rushed. It's very organic. I'm not always trying to create songs. I'm not always trying to write down shit. If I've got a melody in my head, I'll definitely pull out the audio recorder and jot that down. If I've got words, like bars, like witty stuff, if someone pulls something up in a conversation that's like, I might be able to turn that into a rap, I'll write it down. The way I see it is like the vocals is like a husband, it's like a man, and it needs a wife. So that doesn't happen instantly. But once you find the right partner for your vocals, which is the beat, the instrumental, you can develop that relationship between those two people. Do you get me? So it comes naturally. You're never trying to force two people to get together. I've had dreams about it. I've already, you know, I can already see it in my head. Like, you know, you're walking out and, like, there's just the cheering, like, so fucking loud. Your ears hurting, like, lights everywhere, phone lights everywhere. You know, and you just stand there and you just take it in for a second. Definitely the most important is giving back, for sure. I know exactly what it was like to have nothing. For me to be able to use my platform to give back to those less fortunate, which I can totally relate to, you know, it's just a given. It's just something in my nature, you know? Like, we've spoken so much about shit being organic. It's just something that, you know, I wouldn't think twice about doing. So I have this verse that I've just been in my notes for a couple years, like literally. It's still an idea. Still a concept. It might land on something else, but sounds pretty good on this.
Thoughts get deep. Rain on a roof. Quarter past sleep. Knowing I can see what you can see. The sands of time say potentially you and me. Had a plan that spans from way back when. I even had a wrist for the pen in my hand. They like gifts and gold, we've been gifted goals. We've been strictly chosen to gift the souls. While my line's on the mirror, I'm facing ultimatums. I could do the one, or be the one that save them all. Maybe a conversation for another time. Likely a situation that I'm overplaying. I've been alone, I know the case. I'm Valentine without a date. I've got a blossom, no bouquet. Every plague goes down without a trace. Every plague goes down without a trace. Every plague goes down without a trace.
Ladies and gentlemen, Ian McGann.
This is Dr. Janet's Verbal Highs.
Black Hands.
Oh, is it?
Is it called Black Hands?
Oh, yeah. Probably it would have been, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, a lot of them are, well, there's all sorts. I mean, it's just you throw out what you want,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, very good.
These are more in the spirit of we just talk for,
yeah.
We talk for 80 minutes. Have you got that in you?
Yeah, yeah.
Have you got that many stories? So. I'm sure you have.
So. I think so.
Yeah, all right. Yeah. I'll just turn you up a bit. That's
strange. When we were on the road with Billy Connolly last time, his daughter was with us, and she introduced us to This American Life.
Yeah.
It was a very good podcast, and she managed to download some of those, which kept us company for a few miles on the road.
Well, I teach a bit of audio storytelling and radio and whatnot at AUT.
Oh, yeah.
And This American Life's kind of the sort of the poster boy or one of the originators for, because it's sort of public radio turning into podcasting.
Yeah, yeah.
It's funny, we go from from you guys... And the changes that happened with Hauraki, and then here we are, not really that much later in the scheme of humanity, sitting, not broadcasting, but you know, just doing what I want at a kitchen bench.
It's a very novel form of communication.
Yeah,
very much so. Yeah,
I'll introduce you anyway.
Yeah, sure.
My guest today, as you know, is friends with Billy Connolly, which I'm reasonably jealous about. I don't get starstruck too much, but he's one of my favourite human beings. Billy's friend is Ian McGann, a pioneer of both commercial radio and concert promotion in New Zealand. I've stolen this from somewhere else, so you might have read this before. He's equally a man who's considered a true gentleman. Loyalty and old school values, hard work and a genuine passion for music have been the foundation of Ian's career. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Where'd you come from today?
I came over from Devonport, took the public transport, beautiful day.
Beautiful day.
Good trip, yeah.
Auckland born and bred?
No, not at all. I'm a Waikato boy. I grew up on a 100-acre dairy farm, 22 miles out of Hamilton.
Yeah.
And so had my early life and an idyllic childhood, I might add, in that environment.
Mum and Dad wanted you to take over the farm?
No, well, we didn't have that opportunity. We had to leave the farm when I was about 14, and my dad bought a business then. He decided to get into the grocery business, so we moved to Waharoa, a place near Manamata, which was like a factory town.
Yeah.
And I was never interested in getting into grocery, and I'd sort of been away from the farm long enough to, I suppose, lose interest in that.
Yeah.
So I ended up... I really did want to become a broadcaster, actually.
Yeah.
Right from the early days when I first left school, I applied to 1ZH in Hamilton for a job, and couldn't. In those days, you almost had to have a foot long letters after your name to get near a radio
really?
Station.
Really? So they expected
music letters, music knowledge,
right?
Not that it was necessary, but they felt it was.
As part of that that sort of snobbishness that Hauraki sought to overcome, which we'll get to later, but I wanted to ask about that. I mean, you got into radio in, I think it was the early 1960s?
Yeah, 1962. I finally cracked a job in in government radio, NZBC.
And I wanted to ask about that. So before that, being inspired, I mean, obviously, before the days of rock and roll on the radio and stuff, what was inspiring to you as a kid with a little AM radio? What was on air?
Well, there wasn't much in the way of music really in those days, but we glued ourselves to things like the Phil Schoen breakfast session, yeah, where he played quite a lot of music, and the Sunday ZB request session, which, yeah, ran, I think, for 2 hours from 12 to 2 every Sunday. That was like our magic moments. And there were other odd programs on during the week from our local stations,
yeah,
which would feature half an hour of music here and 20 minutes of music there. So we got enough music to get to know our music well. But my particular interest was just in following the songs. You know, we just loved the music.
And so how did you, not a man of musical letters, as it were,
no,
how did you get your foot in that door when you did? How did you convince them?
By the time we got to 62, and I'd been trying to get in since about 1956,
yeah,
I'd had a variety of jobs and been overseas and did a few things. And one could say the standards had dropped by 62, and they were not taking just anybody, but they were taking people who they thought had skills in other areas, like had a decent voice.
Yeah.
Who were potentially good communicators, because interviewing people was becoming an important part of what we were doing.
Yeah.
We were more portable, becoming more portable around town.
Yeah.
We had to be able to mix more in the community. And I think that sort of, it certainly suited me to get into a job like that.
And did you still have pressure to sound like you had one foot in the empire? You know, this,
yes,
sort of...
Yeah. Well, my boss, a lovely man called Keith McIntyre, he grew up in 4YA,
yeah,
Dunedin,
yeah,
back in the 30s, I guess, the,
yeah,
40s.
Right.
And they had to wear a tie, and a white shirt and a tie and a jacket to work. And nobody could see,
yeah, it. Yeah, I was just going to say, isn't it all about theatre of the
and
mind?
It was all very proper, you know. And,
yeah,
they spoke like BBC.
Yeah.
They had beautiful voices, these guys. I always admired their voices.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they spoke and were trained to speak like a BBC commentator or announcer. Whereas we were expected to have great respect for the language in our days. We were better spoken then, in the 60s, than...
Yeah.
The modern,
absolutely,
presenters are, only because time has changed everything.
But there was opening up a sense that you had to start sounding a bit like the New Zealand around you, although keep that sort of classic British broadcasting enunciation.
Very much so. We were expected to speak clearly and to use words properly. We were taught phonetics so that we could understand,
yep,
how a word was constructed.
Yep.
I enjoyed all that,
yeah,
stuff,
absolutely.
You know, and I tried to make a point of using the correct language wherever I could. And of course, then and we had to learn Maori,
yep,
not necessarily to understand, but certainly to speak it.
Yeah,
and that was I enjoyed that part of it as well.
And then it's somehow, you were commandeered by a bunch of long hairs not so long after.
Yeah, well, I'd been in four years in Whanganui, which was a great training ground. Being a country station, you'd had to do everything.
Yeah.
Including sweeping the floor even at times.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine, Paddy O'Donnell, who became a very famous New Zealand disc jockey, among other things, racing commentator, sports commentator, he'd come up to join these ragtags in Auckland who,
yeah,
were just beginning Radio Hauraki, and he'd jumped ship and come on up to Auckland. And he kept ringing me saying, "You've got to get off, you've got to get,
yeah,
off."
Yeah.
I said, "Look,
the big smoke.
I've got a good job, I love, yeah, the job, why should I go to Auckland, yeah, where there's no money and there's no prospect? And anyway, how do I know this thing's going to work?" He said, "It'll work if people like you join it." You know?
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And I'd had a diet of 24-hour radio when I lived in Sydney. I had four very happy years in Sydney when I was younger. And I was used to the great 24-hour radio stations, 2UW, 2UE, 2CH, wonderful stations with great, great personalities behind the microphone. And so I knew what it was all about. I knew what had to be done.
Yeah.
And so did he and a number of others. So just a group of us basically melded together in May 1966.
And for people who don't know, and obviously, Ian, you were there, so you can correct me. I teach this stuff from time to time. You lived it. But, you know, in the same breath, you've mentioned that there's a lot of good for you as a listener and a presenter on the government stations. There was a feeling amongst at least the people starting Hauraki at the time that the government was stifling perhaps creativity or not much creativity, or the zeitgeist, that word they use, that this new stuff was happening.
Stifling personal freedom.
There was no outlet for it, And so personal freedom's interesting, so it extends beyond broadcasting. What do you mean by that, and how did you pick up on that?
Their attitude to broadcasting and to many other rules that governed people in those days were an attack on personal freedom, although that was a term not used in those days. it's one of the end terms that have come up since that time.
Yeah.
We just felt like my New Zealanders were very happy people in those days, and it's wrong to think that things were going to hell in a handcart. They weren't.
Yeah.
It was a lovely place to live, it still is.
Yeah.
But rules were rules, and they had to be stuck to, and part of that was a reluctance on the part of the powers that be to allow any form of communication, post office, PNT, radio, television, to allow any of it in the hands of a private company who may become rogue and anti-government in their outlook.
Yeah.
And so they said, well, we'll hang on to it ourselves.
So it almost sounds like it was a kind of a security paranoia thing.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think they felt as long as they had it under their direct control and that the people were trained only by them in certain ways, again, along the lines of mainly of the BBC, that there would be no problem, you know. And people were getting, obviously, what they wanted on there. They were getting a balance of music and drama, et cetera, sport, which was a huge thing in those days on radio because there were no television.
No.
They were getting their balance of programming, so why change it? That was the attitude, yeah.
So you get up there, how quickly do you figure all this out? You know, I figure the phone calls and so on are a step back from, actually, this is about changing things. Was there a sort of a meeting somewhere or...?
Yeah, well, we all met in Auckland. I remember the night I arrived was our big meeting. We all went to a pub somewhere and got together, about eight of us. David Gapes, of course, and Derek Lowe, the two heads of the organisation. And they told us what they had in mind. I remember sitting there thinking, this is what I've wanted in my life for years and years and years, ever since I was an 18-year-old in Sydney.
And how old are you by now?
By then, 25.
So
it just fell into place. And we didn't have to go around shouting slogans or having signs on our cars or anything. We were just there and doing what we knew, if we were successful, would be a success.
Yeah. Mm. And how did that roll out?
Well, it was a fairly...
You had to find a boat. They had to find a boat.
Yeah, we had to find a boat first.
The titty.
The boys had gotten onto an old wooden coastal vessel, the Tirrey, through a ship owner, Mr. Jim Frankham, who was an Auckland man, and he was a lovely man. He was much older than any of us, and... there was no reason to think that he should help us at all, but he did. He basically said, look, I don't need this thing. You can have it. You pay me when you can.
He said, don't tell the authorities I sold you this, boys.
he was very good. You know, he was a religious man. And the last person you'd expect to favour a bunch of ragtags.
Yeah.
But he did, you know. And we had a lot of people like that. That was the type of support we were getting from quite powerful areas.
Yeah, yeah.
half of it we didn't even know it was coming.
Yeah.
You know, there were people all around the community. Once the word got out of what we intended to do,
yeah,
there were strong areas of conviction in the adult world.
Yeah.
That what we were doing was a good thing.
Yeah, well, like for people who don't know, it was, you know, to me, the Hodaki story is like about a, you know, a wider metaphor of social change in New Zealand, as was sort of being seen around the world as well. And then I'm thinking you have to find, I mean, even now, you know, by virtue of numbers, broadcasting equipment isn't the most common equipment in the world. Did you have sort of a bunch of tinkerers who built stuff, or
we had our group under Doc O'Callaghan, who was one of the founders, a very bright group of technicians, most of whom had worked one stage or another with the NZBC.
Yeah,
and they were basically, as you said, tinkered together.
Yeah.
And Chris Parkinson, who was one of our jocks.
Yeah.
And a very clever technician. Yeah. He built our first console and bought a couple of Garrard turntables from the local retailer, and suddenly we had a studio. Yeah.
And for, you know, it's not gravity, I'm trying to think what it is. For the lay of the sea, and a lot of people might not consider this, records don't fare well in the open ocean. So I think a lot of people don't know. It was the tapes taken out, wasn't it?
Yeah, we pre-recorded everything because we couldn't play the records at sea. So we would record exactly a week before on half our tapes.
Yeah.
Having two or three tape recorders that would just change over at the end of one tape, beginning of another.
Yeah.
And they would be shipped out to Great Barrier Island, to Tryphena. And then Bill Gibbs, the fisherman at Tryphena, would take them out from where the aircraft would land to our ship.
See, a little things on Hodaki, like you got a mood of support from, as you say, you know, a wide range of New Zealanders, perhaps people older at the time you didn't expect, and so on. What was the, I mean, there's the famous scene with the police and so on, but what was the response from, quote-unquote, the authorities? Were you guys heavied, or, I know the attitude changed, because obviously eventually you were granted the license, but was it quite sort of, did you feel like you were in quite a precarious situation for a while there?
In that period, May through December 66, which is the period that we started getting the boat ready for action at sea, and when we finally got to air. In that period, we were being heavied all right by the government.
Yeah.
There was this huge conflict of interest between the Minister of Marine, the Minister of the Post Office, because the Post Office hated us, because they were responsible for regulating communications in the country, and, of course, the Minister of Broadcasting.
Yeah.
Now, Marine and Broadcasting were controlled by the same minister, Jack Scott.
Yeah.
So he was encouraged to use his powers, and I don't believe it was his decision alone. I never have. But he was encouraged to use his powers to create diversions that would throw us off the track. And so we were getting certificates from marine inspectors saying this boat's not seaworthy, you can't sail on this boat, it's not fit, blah, blah, blah. And we'd say to them, look, you're just trying to stop us broadcasting. They'd say, we have no interest in broadcasting. We're purely interested in, well, that was bullshit.
Yeah.
And so finally got to the head where we said, look, we've had enough of this. They've been stuffing us around for so long. And October, the long weekend of 66, we decided to sail. The word had got out through the Sunday news.
Yeah.
And there was this huge crowd. That was the turning point. The crowd turned up. The crowd of supporters we had no idea was going to be so huge.
Yeah.
And so diversified. They weren't just kids.
Yeah. You know,
they were kids, their parents, grandparents, everything.
Really?
And they turned up at the viaduct where the boat was. And, of course, we had the famous incident of trying to get the boat out the gap of the viaduct. They lowered the bridge on it. And we got it pulled free from the bridge by this massive crowd at the end of a rope. And it started to sail. But by this time, the cops had arrested us and were taken back to town. And had to face charges in the court for sailing, sailing without a marine certificate, I think, was one of the charges. So we went to court, and of course, then that's when we sort of became heroes in a way, because with the help of Roger McLaren, a wonderful lawyer who later became a lifelong friend, we proved a case of conspiracy against the government.
That's
it
quite
was a wonderful time.
That's, you know, that sounds a lofty charge to prove in any era, really.
We never, the rank and file in this group, never thought that would happen.
Yeah.
We thought we would maybe someday get through the law somehow, but we never thought until this one civil servant was questioned in the court. We never realised that Roger had information that this guy was part of a conspiracy.
Wow.
And he forced him to admit it in court. Yeah. And what a day.
Oh, there's so many layers to this. I'm thinking, because for you, I mean, well, all of you, but it's you sitting here now, it sounds like you learnt a whole lot in a short period of time that wasn't just about broadcasting, right?
Oh, yeah, we did. We did. We learned a lot about the diverseness of government.
What do you mean by that?
How diverse they could be in terms of trying to stop us using Plan A to stop Plan C and so on, you know, misusing their powers. And we learned a lot about how much we needed the support of the public to make this thing work at all.
Well, that's, and again, I'm telling you about the history you lived, but that's my understanding too, that the reason the authorities relented was public opinion, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah,
pretty well. See, I've got a cough.
No, that's right. I've got to. I've got to turn the volume up on my phone, which I forgot to do. So, for listeners not familiar with the Hodak story, as I say, after a period, I think you were granted a full. Not if it's commercial license or what it's called, but a non-governmental license. But there were a handful of. Non-government run stations up till then, but they weren't doing much different, were they? So,
well, there were a couple.
Yeah,
Forexo Dunedin had always, for some reason, independent.
Yeah,
and I think there was one in Gisborne, and I never actually found out how that happened because everything was nationalised in 1936.
Yeah. I committed it to memory for a lecture. I'll get back to you in the next week or two and tell you how it happened. I can't remember.
It'd be interesting to know.
And you guys were... This is another thing that really interests me about how radio's changed for better or for worse. You were what they call in the States freeform radio, weren't they? And that you just played what you wanted.
Yeah. We weren't programmed by any philosophy or anything. Well, we had our own philosophy. We wanted to play top 40 music, basically.
Yeah.
And whatever was coming out of the States and the UK mainly in those days was on the top 40 charts was good enough for us.
Yeah.
But we had the overlaying plank also of having a great need to support the local artists.
Yeah.
And so we, I think, helped create a lot of top 20 hits for local artists as well.
Well, absolutely.
And that was a very pleasing part of our job.
If pop culture is being censored by the very virtue of what the government chooses to play, absolutely. I've heard tales of, didn't you have, it was the airline hosts, airline stewards, not smuggling cocaine, but smuggling vinyl records, wasn't it?
A couple of captains. They'd go into Tower Music in LA, which was the famous record store in those days, buy up the top 10, and you know, come and see us and give them to us. You know,
no one questions the captain as they walk through Hottest Records.
No. We became quite friends with quite a few of the air crew for that reason. You know.
So related to the freeform thing, you know, as I was saying before, this interests me. What do you think about radio playlists now? I think they've been really siloed by the competition between the two, the two big companies, haven't they? Doesn't even pick a record now on a lot of those stations.
No, that's all pretty well an automatic process. And of course, I think it even makes a difference that you can't actually see the thing you're playing. You know, we had things that you could touch and I can remember the colour and the label of just about every record I ever played, you know, because it was just part of what we did.
Yeah.
And so it had a sort of a personality within itself.
Yeah.
It is very.
I'm right with you.
Electronic and formatted.
Now. I'm right with you. I come from the same background, I guess, like a lot of radio people did, of liking not only the music but the presenting side of it, and that modern take on it, where it's just sort of going in and to me, it's like one of the limbs is missing for why I got into it. But you know, at the same time,
But, you know, a lot of people say, and I'm not going to be the one that says it's wrong, because...
Well, that's what I was going to say. People
I'm
find...
Out of that era now, but a lot of people say that's just the way it's going. And it's a bit like a lot of people saying the way live music's going. It's getting into some unintelligible sort of area that none of us can really understand or appreciate.
Yeah.
But then I'm not 16.
No. And it was, you see? You and I are on the same page. I was about to say, I'm always hesitant to go.
You've
got to
have
in the
respect
past.
For what... Yeah. The other generation wants and will respond to. So to that extent, but to me it's boring. Modern radio is boring. I find myself being much more of a fan of the Leighton Smiths of this world than I was of the great music guys, you know.
Yeah, I think that's – I've got to say, actually, that's you know, there's a decade or two between us, but I found that's something that just happens post 40. I joke on the podcast because I talk for 80 minutes now, and it's like I used to look at my grandfather and go, oh, I'll never just listen to talk off a speaker all the time, but I find that's what I do.
Well, you do
a lot of the time.
You graduate
now.
To that,
yeah.
But we actually went through quite a catharsis in the mid 70s, which was the time I got out of radio.
Yeah,
we were. We had discovered the American style of formatting radio, so that you were very specific in the type of music you played.
Yeah.
It wasn't just top 40 anymore; it was a particular type of music.
Yeah,
and adult, we were employing consultants.
Yeah.
People like Chuck Bloor and Don Richman, who were famous American radio consultants, and they were advising us to go about this. While we were very excited about the idea of going this way and restricting ourselves and not being able to play a lot of music we actually wanted to, we went along with it because that was the way the American radio scene was going.
Yeah.
And I often think we were wrong doing that. I think we lost a lot of our independence at that time.
Well, that sort of tails into what we've talked about with the style of radio now, where it's very niche but very mainstream formatting and sounds.
Yes.
So you move out of radio because... you basically move into the touring racket, but the touring racket comes off the back of the fact that Hauraki were putting on shows because it was about, I guess, a whole scene rather than just the radio station.
It was almost a natural progression for me.
So how did that come about? I mean, I know about the dollar shows, I know about what happened at Hauraki and so on, but when did you actually start to say, shit, I can, I'm going to have a go at actually, you know, putting on concerts myself? And charging at the gate, as it were.
Well, as so often happens, it was almost an accident.
Yeah.
I was pretty convinced by mid 76 that I was going to move.
Yeah.
And at that time, I'd become very friendly with John Clark, the great Fred Dagg. And he was doing little 1 minute vignettes for our radio station as a sort of a side job. He was very famous around the country on TV, of course. And he and I met in Auckland one day, and how are you getting on? Oh, well, I'm sick and tired of TV in New Zealand. They're treating me like an office boy. And I said, well, why don't you think about doing a live tour, you know, go around the country. You never go and see the people that you've become famous with. And he quite liked the idea, and I thought, well, this is a springboard for me too.
Yeah.
I was always interested in the live entertainment industry. I knew all the promoters and stuff through the radio. I thought I'll have a go at it too, and I'll promote it, and he and I put the show together, and away we went.
In those days of TV, the way it was, I mean, he's known everywhere.
Oh yeah, he was a universal hit. Yeah.
And so, how do you attract these brilliant comedians as close friends, Ian? What is it?
I don't know.
Fred, Billy, and so how did the tour go? You took him on the road. You have to learn about everything from the ground up.
We went out on the road. We planned a three-week tour of all the little towns. He wanted to go in the small towns. We'd go into places like Twice or Timaru and that.
Yeah.
And this thing just exploded. It just went nuts. Yeah. All the tickets sold out. Well, what are we going to do now? So is that right? While we're doing the three-week tour, we'll plan a six-week tour to follow the three-week tour.
Right.
And we went around the country again.
It's becoming like Metallica. It'll go 4 years.
And that was all in 76, because he had by then decided he was going to leave New Zealand. He was going to live in Australia, which he did until he sadly died last year.
He seldom came back, didn't he, once he left?
Very seldom. Very seldom.
Do you know what that was about?
He wasn't a great flyer.
Right, yeah.
And he really had made Australia his home.
Yeah.
He wasn't a great fan of the New Zealand politics for much of the time.
Yeah.
And I think he just felt comfortable in the artistic environment of Melbourne. And
Fair enough.
He did so well there, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Bloody national hero there as well, you know.
Just a star quality, obviously, because a lot of people, you know, go to other places and what they had one spot doesn't eventuate somewhere else, does it?
No, well, he and Helen brought up their family there and they had a very successful life, you know.
Yeah.
I stayed in touch with him right through, but... we're always great friends, but no, I tried to get him back for the millennium. I said, you've got to come back.
Yeah, yeah.
We're going to do a New Zealand tour right on the millennium.
Yeah.
Because, you know, to me, he was the greatest comedic export New Zealand had ever had at that time.
Yeah.
And Billy T's the only other one, I think.
Yeah.
And I said, come on, let's celebrate the century. You're the best comedian we've ever had. And he was sort of mildly interested, but in the end... he dropped the idea.
Just found his comfortable spot and stayed there. Fair enough.
Yeah, it was fair enough. Yeah, it didn't matter.
And you know, obviously that moves to music. I was thinking today because promoting's often such a thankless task publicly. Might be worth pointing out. You've toured AC/DC more than once.
Yep.
You toured Michael Jackson.
Yep.
Assuming that's 93 when I went.
Yep.
And I didn't even realise it was kind of historical that I went
then. Right. Yeah.
And then everything, you know, fell apart from not soon after that.
Yeah.
You've toured Elton.
Yep.
You've had a long-running personal and touring relationship with Billy, which I've mentioned about five times now. who else? Who are the acts you've done over the years?
Pavarotti.
Absolutely. Yeah.
He was one of my... my most unexpected coups, if you want to call it. Gray Bartlett and I were running the company at the time.
Yeah.
And they came to us and said, would you like to do Pavarotti? And I said, you've got to be bloody joking, you know.
Not cool enough for you?
No, I wanted to do, because my music.
Oh, you thought he was just out of your league, like.
I just thought of way out of our league.
Yeah, sorry, excuse me.
I loved all his music. Yeah. I've got a very broad taste in music, I suppose, which they used to give me a hard time at the rock and roll station about that. But no, I said, if I could do Pavarotti, I'd just about do it for nothing. I didn't tell them that.
Yeah.
and our company got behind it, and we did it. And it was a great night, great experience.
How far
because
into...
Because he was a living legend.
Absolutely. How far into you... touring artist was this? Which tour was
this? That was 1999. November 1999. It wasn't a long time before. I think he died a couple of years later.
Not much later. Yeah. And had he not toured New Zealand before that?
Never.
Amazing.
He'd been to Australia two or three times with Dame Joan Sutherland.
Yeah.
And maybe the Three Tenors. I think he did it once with the Three Tenors. But that was his only visit to New Zealand.
Yeah.
And he went and saw the Italian... America's Cup Syndicate while I was here.
Yeah, right.
And they
must have nearly fallen over.
They were crying.
Was he into boating or just it was the patriotism of it for Pavarotti?
He'd heard that they were here and that they'd been away from home a long time, and so we asked to go and see them. And they welcomed them. That was a great.
And
how does it work?
I mean, I've done some work with people putting on shows over the years, and I've seen differing degrees of connection. But for someone like you dealing with such large artists...
Well, we don't really get too involved with the artists because They're people that have been pestered all their lives by, not just support people management and so on, but by the public. So we try and give them as much privacy and their own form of freedom as we can.
Yeah.
So we don't hang out with them unless they want us to.
Yeah.
Some artists may be a little insecure, many are, and may want to go out with their promoter because they feel more secure if they're out in public.
Yeah.
But generally, we leave them as much as we can to do their own thing, but we're always there if they need us.
Yeah.
And that's worked well.
Yeah.
That works well.
We only just started this list. Pavarotti, Dire Straits, which has got a...
Dire Straits was our biggest, yeah.
Biggest, and an ongoing relationship. Mm-hmm. Who else? A few more.
Well, even I feel.
I don't often get people to reel off lists, but as I say, it's an impressive.
I'd had a very great relationship with the Finn Boys and Split Ends in those early days.
Yeah,
Really enjoyed my years with them. I wasn't their manager. I was just their promoter,
but
their own management.
But like with the Fred Dagg story, you sort of got them off the ground as a touring act, didn't you?
I suppose we expanded their touring horizons a bit, but they were already well known before I'd actually linked up with them.
Yeah,
they were famous for their Dollarhead concerts with the Hauraki and all this sort of stuff some years before. But we went right through to 1984 with them, 1984. And it was wonderful to see their popularity grow as it did internationally. Those were treasured moments. But we spent a lot of time with Australian acts too. Ivor Davies and Ice House.
Yeah.
A lot of those great Australian bands that would come out every couple of years and do very good business.
Yeah.
We enjoyed a lot of that, you know. Again, I can't remember half their names, but
that's all right. I was going to ask you about this. You are speaking in the past tense. Are you out of the racket now? Have you retired? Or
basically, yeah.
Yeah. What was the last tour
we have
you did?
Got the Hollies coming back?
Okay,
we've done the Hollies every year for the last 25 years.
Yeah,
every time they've come back, we've done them. So Gray and I are doing them again.
And other heritage acts I think I saw you did the Glenn Miller Band not so long ago as well.
Yeah, I did that with an Australian promoter, Tony Brady, which was hugely successful, actually.
Yeah.
Even though the audience is very old.
Yeah.
We had to make a special concessions at times. Yeah. But,
lots of ice cream, I find. You'll sell lots of ice cream. So someone like Michael Jackson, I mean, to me, I tend, you know, not to be starstruck often, but there's some people to me who are almost sort of like cartoon characters in their fame, if you know what I mean.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
How was the experience of bringing one of the icons of...
aura about them, you know.
One of the icons of kind of popular culture out.
Well, again, it was a great privilege to work with them, but... I hardly met him.
Yeah.
I hardly saw him.
Yeah.
He had a big group around him. He was a very insecure person. And we weren't in a hurry to hang out with him or do anything like that.
Yeah.
We met him and said hello a couple of times backstage, and that was about it. That didn't worry me immensely. What I was worried about was his ability... whether he would have the ability to perform the athletic type of show that he's famous for in this huge outdoor environment at Mount Smart Stadium.
I think I remember he did pretty well.
I was really concerned.
Yeah.
And he just killed it.
He was amazing. Yeah.
He just killed it. He was so fit.
Yeah.
And so good at what, so professional, you know. You could hear every word he was singing, even if he might be 40 foot up a pole.
Yeah, I seem to remember some mechanical arm or something.
Oh,
yeah,
my
yeah.
God, he's just amazing.
And sometimes memories aren't accurate. Do I have some recollection of a tank or some similar thing at the end of the show? Had some, or did Heal the World? And
yeah, that's right. Yeah. There was. I can't remember.
To this day, I'm like, how did they do that? Maybe it was on a video screen.
Oh, the staging was immense. It took a week and a half to build the whole set, you know.
And so with that, Ian, with those huge acts, that's flowing around the world as part of the show
of the
as well,
big
isn't
ones
it?
It is, yes.
Yeah.
AC/DC fly, all this stuff, everything, technicians, everything.
Yeah.
Jackson did.
Yeah.
A number of others. New Zealand has become quite good now at building these big stagings.
Yeah.
We've got good contractors here now who've had a lot of experience. So less and less of them are bringing their own stuff because it's so expensive, you know.
I see. So there's
like nine 747s or something.
Nine.
It's crazy.
Wow.
Whereas if you can build a lot of that here, you're saving a fortune for the band.
Yeah. Does that reflect in, I don't know if it's untoward questioning, but does that reflect in what you get charged for the act if you can save them?
Yeah.
Right.
If we can talk them into using local people and local products.
Comes off the bottom line.
Then it would make it somewhat cheaper,
yeah.
They may not give us a discount on the whole thing, but they it's show business, you know. It's business. If you can save $100,000 here, then you can at least share it with your promoter, or you know, make a deal with them where the savings are to the benefit of everybody.
Do you think that
even the ticket price,
right? Do you think that we'll get to that later on, because I've seen how active you are in that modern day racket of people making money for nothing, which we'll get to later.
Yeah.
But do you think that, from what I've seen of promoting, I mean, obviously you get skilled, you get as risk averse as you can. Do you still think it's a form of a gamble or gambling in terms of the... Do you think you get a rush from that in terms of that way of operating?
Yeah, you do.
Yeah.
Because you never know going into any project whether it's going to make a profit or not.
Yeah.
So, in other words, is my house on the line?
Well, when you said 9 747s, I was like, oh, boy, I hope he sells tickets.
And, you know, you pay a deposit on that show.
Yeah.
So it's got to go. It's got to work.
Yeah.
But, they are all a risk, but I think we get quite good at making a valued judgment before the event.
Yeah.
The place where you can really make mistakes, and I made a couple, where an act is very hot in America and very hot in New Zealand at the same time.
Yeah.
But by the time they finally do a world tour and get to New Zealand, they've gone off the boil with the public.
Yeah. Why is that band that had a number one touring 2 years ago, one 2 years ago touring now?
And so we've always tried to stick, for that reason, we've always tried to stick with the acts that we knew had legs.
Yeah.
Who would last more than a year or two or three.
And so back in the day, was it things like talking to people around record stores, radio stations, you know, in terms of like what's going on in the ground?
That was our research base.
Yeah.
That was our research base, apart from what we'd learn ourselves from overseas trips, reading Billboard and all that sort of stuff, and that was all important. We talked to radio station programmers.
Yeah.
Jocks.
Yeah.
And particularly record stores, actually.
Yeah.
Colin Morris, the famous record store owner in Wellington.
I've given Colin Morris
and
a whole
bunch of them up here.
Yeah.
People like Tim Murdoch, who ran WEA Music here for years, also sadly passed away now. He had an encyclopedic knowledge of artists and music, and you could ring Tim and say, what do you reckon? And he'd tell you.
But their knowledge you'd want would be of what the public want, not their knowledge of the artist, need to know.
Yeah.
I had someone recently show me that with things like, I don't know if I'll get this right, but something like Bandcamp or, you know, any of those online things now where you can buy an independent artist music, those guys who, you know, go around and tour rooms that only fill 200 people in the States or whatever, can look from New Zealand, if they've got the premium service, and see where in countries like Australia and US, you know, where their music's been sold.
Oh, yeah.
So they can, I mean, that's huge intel compared to...
It's remarkable.
How did technology, you know, how has... I mean, it's such a broad question, Ian, but, you know, how has How did technology change things over the years?
Well, I think it's made the guesswork a little more important because we don't have record stores anymore, for example, yeah. is what you're alluding to. You've got to get your information from other sources. But there's very good publications around the world, Audience Magazine in the UK,
yeah.
the big American trades are still going strong. And we learn a lot from them.
Yeah.
And as journalism becomes more cutting edge, we're getting more truthful stuff put through those mags. It's not just handouts anymore.
Not just press releases.
The guts of, like if so-and-so has a bad show in New York, you'll read about it the next day.
Right.
Whereas there was a time when you would never know.
You got an air freighted copy of NME like a month after the show's happened.
Yeah.
So dwelling on the positive, though, I did catch that you said you made a couple of mistakes.
Yeah.
Yeah, show-wise. Did you have artists that didn't quite connect?
Act like the Motels was a good example where they had a top hit here in America. And we said, book them. We've got to book them now. And we booked them and then they turned up 6 months later. And we didn't do very well at all. We lost some money on it just because that audience, which was a young, 14, 15, 16-year-old audience, had moved on to another artist.
Yeah.
And that, so you learn that lesson fairly quickly.
Yeah, early on, thankfully.
And I must say, there are promoters in New Zealand, like Brett Eccles and others, who are very good at working with new artists, and they understand them better than I ever did. I've always enjoyed working with established artists where I can.
Yeah.
And using, I suppose, my reputation to have that artist come back time and time again.
Yeah.
That's always worked for us, Gray and me and others that have been in the business.
When you say we, how many people does it take to, in your heyday of the company, how many of are there working under you?
We'd have two or three partners, some of them silent. But we'd have a...
It's just you on the ground and contractors. Eight people and then contractors on the shows and stuff.
Oh, yeah, a lot of our work is contracted out, all the sound, the light.
Yeah.
Even at times, a lot of our promotion and advertising is contracted out, although we do our own now.
Yeah.
Because it's a lot cheaper and we think we get a better result. But, a lot of it's contracted out. If we had those people on our payroll, we'd have a staff of 40.
Yeah, that's right. And you'd have to figure out what to do with them 9 months of the year.
Exactly, exactly.
Excuse me. Was it you that toured Metallica through?
No, I never toured Metallica.
Because I was going to, excuse me. I've caught the cough.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, do you want some more water, by the way?
Yeah, no, I'm fine.
Okay. The reason I asked that was I thought someone had said you had, and it was about sort of diversity of music choices. Now, it is a business. It's this funny thing of, like, the art that you love and the business. Mm. Have you always considered your taste alongside what you tour?
Yeah, well, I try not to let my taste affect me because it's too damn broad,
Yeah. That sounds better than too...
There's a lot of stuff that I would really like to do in the more serious vein, but I know won't work. Particular singers and
you mean serious
orchestral type work,
right,
that sort of thing.
Sure.
So there's a lot of stuff I'd love to do because I like what they do, but you can't afford to put it on a place like New Zealand. On the other hand, there's a whole lot of contemporary music that I would really like to do, but for different reasons, there was somebody else, or I don't know enough about them to be confident.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. So, again, you try and go with the best judgment you can make at the time.
With artists coming in, I just think about the New Zealand you started in compared to the New Zealand of today. Mm. How did the earlier artists sort of, react to a country that was kind of often seemed closed compared to where they were from.
I can remember when I was a teenager, guys like Nat King Cole were coming to New Zealand, and he was one of our idols as kids, He was as big to us in the 1950s as any of these big artists are today to their audiences.
Yeah.
And we'd see photos of Nat King Cole performing at the Auckland Town Hall or Western Springs or wherever it might be, on a stage with no roof, a black piano, and two other musicians, you know.
Yeah.
And a sound system that was made for a race course.
Yeah, beautiful.
You know, the old tenor speakers.
Yeah.
And you'd think, well, I could never afford to go to those shows. I always wanted to.
Yeah.
It makes you wonder what sort of quality the shows were, but we just didn't have the gear.
I was also meaning, like, were artists ever, like, kind of like, where the fuck am I?
Yeah, well, you know, we had a lot of artists would be open-mouthed with dismay as they came off the aeroplane.
Yeah.
This is when I started, even in the 70s.
Yeah.
I can remember Three Dog Night's manager.
Yeah.
As they got off the plane and came through customs, and I'm there to welcome them, and he turns around to the boys, he says, "Here you are, boys. This is New Zealand, the asshole of the world."
Oh, no.
He'd been here once before.
Really?
Hadn't had a good experience. That was our welcome to the band. Luckily, they later disagreed with him. They got to like the place quite a bit.
We don't need him and John Cleese on our tourism ads.
But no, artists would arrive. The big problem they had, apart from customs, who were very suspicious in those days. This is pre-drugs, almost.
Yeah.
They were still suspicious.
But it's back to that.
They're good now.
Talking about with Hauraki, it's like that sort of like a nation built on authority, a lot were back then.
It was.
I've got a uniform on. Yeah.
But sorry, the real problems we would have with the artists was, what do they do at night when they got a night off? Where do they go for dinner
That's what I was meaning.
Seven.
I'm not dissing my own country. I'm more meaning that. Like, you're not in an international...
Tough. Yeah. That was hard. And for us to try and... I remember my early struggles touring Billy because he always loved, and most artists like to eat after the show.
Yeah.
So you've got to find a restaurant that'll stay open until 10:30 or 11. And it was a nightmare.
Yeah.
In some towns, we actually, one night in Auckland, we went like hell across town after the show at the town hall with Billy to an Indian restaurant. I won't tell you the name of it. I think they're still going.
I think there's good publicity.
Billy's Avenue.
Yeah.
And they had said they would stay open for us.
And they were closed?
And the woman was closing the doors when we arrived. And I said, oh, hang on, no, we've made arrangements. No, no, you're too late.
Yeah.
So she, you know.
Yeah.
Very embarrassing.
Very embarrassing. Like, I mean, it's still...
That went on for a while.
Yeah. It's better. I mean, it's still hard to find late night food compared to overseas now, but...
Yeah, we still have to look around for it sometimes.
But then other, you know, people would fall for the, whichever era it is. I'm sure many an artist fell under the spell of New Zealand, you know, whether you could get a meal after 8 o'clock or not.
Well, they did. Without doubt, they all, you know, once you start driving them around the country.
Yeah.
If it's driving tour.
That's right.
They get really sucked in by it.
They got to see the Lord of the Rings before the Lord of the Rings was filmed.
Exactly. Exactly, and it's the little things, like they get to love our ice cream.
Yeah,
they all love our ice cream.
Yeah,
they love
our dairy. It's
they love Cloudy Bay wine.
Yeah,
you know, and the word goes down through the artists, and they tell their friends, and a new artist will come out and say, "Where do I get Cloudy Bay?"
Yeah,
you know? And so you've got all these things that are very New Zealand that they just and you know, roast lamb, which they hardly eat.
Absolutely.
The English do, but the Yanks don't.
A lot of the rest of Europe don't either. Had had a non blood, you know, married in relative of the family. His parents came over, the German, and they couldn't get their head around the roast lamb. Like, they actually, you know, it was an odd thing to eat.
Oh yeah, no, we've had some good experiences with our food since we've become more food and eating hours oriented. They've got to love our food. Yeah.
So you brought. Let's talk about Billy now, because as I say, I you know, he's actually one of my you know, favourite people outside of people I know. Yeah, you know,
mine too.
I think he's just a fabulous human being. And yeah, so just Ian, talk a little bit about how did you even originally forge the connection with him?
Funny too. Yeah. Way back in 1978,
yeah,
I'd only been in the business a couple of years, and life was a bit tough. A couple of kids at home, and
yeah,
you know, mortgage.
You're at that point where you're thinking, "Will I keep?"
Well, no, but I was struggling, you know.
Yeah.
And I was on my own then. I just ran the company on my own.
Yeah.
And I got this call from this anonymous television producer in Sydney. And he said, look, I'm touring a guy called Billy Connolly.
Yeah.
I can't be bothered doing New Zealand. I think he would do quite well there.
Yeah.
Do you want him? And my answer was, who the hell is Billy Connolly? I'd never heard
of him. Can I interject for a sec? Were his records selling here at the time?
Well, they were, actually, but I didn't know about it. You see? And, of course, they weren't on radio.
Yeah, no.
So we didn't know anything about it on radio. anyway, I said, okay, as a punt, because the deal was very good.
Yeah.
I only had to pay him a lot of money if he did very, very well.
Oh, that's good.
And if he didn't do very well, I would pay him a smaller amount of money.
Yeah.
So I said, well, that's fair.
Yeah.
And Billy and I have worked on that same basis ever since.
Really?
Ever since.
Yeah.
He gets a percentage of it. He trusts us. We trust him.
Yeah.
Boom, boom, boom. And it's been a fantastic relationship.
Yeah.
Not a great friendship, actually.
Yeah.
Because we've toured him 15 times.
Whoa, 15? Not so.
Since 1978.
To be clear, I mean, I know that you don't mean 15 shows. You mean he's come to New Zealand and back 15
tours.
Times.
Yep.
Yeah.
And each time we would put on more and more shows. Like, it was quite common to do 3 weeks, and he'd have one night off a week, so that's 21 less three. 19 shows, 18 shows in 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Bang, bang, bang.
Yeah. And
he was a great worker, and he loved it. He just loved doing it.
And you guys just, you clicked as mates.
Did. Yeah, we did. And about 20 years ago, we produced with him, we co-produced the Billy Connolly World Tour of New Zealand for the BBC TV.
Oh, were you behind that?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
So Steve, his manager, rang me. I'll never forget that. He said, look, we want to do a tour, but we want to do a TV show as well.
Yeah.
Can you find us a film company to do it? So anyway, we ended up, after talking to a couple of film companies in New Zealand, video companies, we ended up deciding we're better off doing this thing ourselves and hiring a good cameraman, a good sound man, a good locations manager, which we did. We hired about five good film people.
People at the top of each of their crafts.
And then put my crew around them.
Yeah.
And away we went. And we had this amazing tour. And we decided that because we were filming this, we would go to strange places like Stewart Island, for God's sake.
So you're actually, unlike other acts where you said you'd sort of leave them to it, you're actually, you're pretty much behind the camera in all of that show. Like, you were part of the
Well,
of
I
the
was
tour.
Part of the production team.
Yeah.
But I wasn't on the camera. But
no, but I mean, you were in on the experience.
It was mainly my job to put the tour on.
Yeah.
And then the group that we'd got together did the filming and did all the production work. We had our own chopper. The government gave us a chopper, our own beautiful helicopter, on the basis that we would let them have all of our unused footage for the tourism department.
Really?
So we gave them a whole pile of stuff they've used ever since for New Zealand tourism, and we got a free chopper out of
Things
it.
Things have come full
Six
circle.
6 weeks.
Did you say, hey, I'm the guy from Hauraki, you're giving me a helicopter now?
No, we just, they actually offered it to us.
Oh, absolutely.
Tourism New Zealand was so keen to get a whole range of footage for the place, like Stewart Island, the West Coast, our footage from the West Coast, up the sounds from helicopters, was still in my mind some of the best footage ever taken in that area.
I'm trying to remember, was part of the premise of the show that he'd do, that's you.
Sorry.
It's all right, you need to get it.
No.
Part of the premise of the show was that what was he doing shows in places like Stewart Island? Would he do it?
No.
Just the main centres.
But we went to these smaller places, two or three of them, just to give variety to the to the film that we were making. And so we played it like 360 people in Stewart Island, which I think was the population. And then the next night we'd be in some arena in Christchurch, but in a normal... But what we successfully did, and it's the only time I've ever done it, is successfully melded a good tour with the video component.
Yeah.
And were able to produce both at the same time.
Yeah, wow. That's amazing.
So that was enormous savings.
And is he someone that you'd try and see the show a lot of the nights?
Every night.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because every night... He was one of those rare comedians that basically, by the time he comes back in 2 years' time, he's worked up a new show.
Yeah.
So you're not getting the same jokes all the time.
No.
At all.
No. Yeah.
He will retell the odd great experience because it's so damn fun.
Yeah, yeah.
But generally, you're getting a new show as he sweeps through each time.
Brilliant. I saw him with my girlfriend at the time. In Sydney, it would have been that tour. It would have been here as well. It would have been around 2004 or 5 with the graffiti backdrop. Anyway, that doesn't matter. Yeah. Point of the story is...
I remember that one.
Yeah, point of the story is that, you know, he's on stage for ages. I mean, it must have been over 2 hours, maybe 3.
Usually over 2 hours, often 3.
And I laughed so hard the whole time.
Yeah.
But, you know, that great thing with laughter like that, you know, as did my partner... And then when we left, I said to her, we started talking about what we recalled, and you know, it was just such post entertainment euphoria that we couldn't actually recall most of the stuff we'd laughed at the time.
He
gets you to that level of
and there's so much content. It's hard to remember it all too. You know?
Yeah.
But the guy's he's incredible.
Have you spoken to him, you know, since his health's turned?
Yeah, a couple of times. I've been in touch with him quite recently, actually.
Yeah.
He's living in America now, and. This damn Parkinson's hasn't done him any favours, but he's doing fine. He's you know, he's keeping himself in good. He looks after himself very, very well. Always did.
Yeah.
Always did. He was...
You're going to throw that out there. That's an interesting tale too, that, you know, he was spotted by a doctor and a fan in a lobby, wasn't he, who said, hey, I can tell by the way you're walking, you should, I mean...
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, he told the story when he was here last time. But it's the most amazing audience development I've seen in my time in the business, where the first tour in 78, nobody knew him, or very few people.
Oh, we didn't get to that. Did people turn up for the first tour?
So most of the people that turned up were drunken Scotsmen, because they loved it. They knew him from... home.
That sounds like most of the white population of New Zealand.
They turn up at the theatre, arm in arm,
you
know, about 10 of them, mostly men,
singing
their hearts out, pissed to beat the band. And of course, we'd have all sorts of trouble with these guys because you get the bit of violence and the odd fight. And I'm spending half my time as a thrower-outer.
Yeah.
But this is just the first tour.
Yeah.
But from that point on, the New Zealand audience started to grow real quick as the word of mouth got out.
Well, I think even things like...
And it's amazing how that happened.
You got me thinking about it, like, because there was, you know, for good reasons and not so advantageous reasons, having only a few media outlets then, you know, a positive one for Billy, I was just thinking, would have been that Parkinson was airing here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so once he'd been a guest on that a few times, told that bicycle joke.
Well, yeah. He credits Parkinson
with
making him famous right from the start in the UK and around, you know, the Northern Hemisphere as well.
And he's philosophical about, you know, finishing touring. I just hope for the man that post-touring, you know, that can be often when you change something so significant.
Yeah. No, I think he's just, he's managing his life very well.
Yeah.
I don't think we'll see him perform again.
I think he made that clear. Yeah. I think he made that clear.
But he's fine.
There was a great
Great family.
Great show on. Yeah, I loved that book that Pamela wrote. I've read that. Not many books I have read more than once, but that would be one of them.
Yeah, it was a very good book.
First book of his. Mm. There's a great show on TVNZ On Demand at the moment. You might have already seen that. I really liked how they did it. It's half very famous people, but they just have their first name on the screen, and then just Joe Public from New Zealand or America or wherever, just talking about the different things that, that Billy's done
Billy
for their
me.
Life.
It's called Billy and Me.
Yeah, do you saw it?
Yeah, I saw it the other night. Well, it's been on before.
Yeah.
It's a very good show.
Good show. Yeah. So thinking of Billy, and you said he's always looked after himself. He's also famously, just moving on to another topic, he's famously talked about his demeanour on booze and then giving up, I think, early 40s.
Yep, he did.
It's a hedonistic industry.
Yes.
How have you navigated your way through that?
Well, yeah. In fact, he was a big drinker when I first toured him in 78. He would have stopped drinking probably about two tours after that, after he met Pamela, basically.
Yeah.
And we had some interesting times in the pubs after the show.
You can't hear that. You can't hear Ian smiling.
I remember the one night it was the just before that aborted Springbok tour of New Zealand.
Right.
And we're in Southland of all places, and we were talking about. And he had a very strong view about apartheid and that they shouldn't come.
Yeah.
And he voiced this view in the public bar while the Southland rugby team were in the bar at the same time.
Shit.
There was nearly a fight over that.
Was he famous enough to pull it off back then, or they didn't know?
Yeah.
Okay.
Nobody came to punches or anything, but I'll tell you something else too, being the man that he was and is. If anybody had taken a swing at him, they'd have known all about it.
Yeah, man from the dockyards.
Yeah, man from the dockyards. He knew how to look after himself.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So yeah, so I mean, that's that side of the industry. Like it, you know, it often it takes people down.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I've seen alcohol do strange things to people, but even worse, you see more harm from the drugs.
Yeah,
I must say. But I've seen both of them.
Speaking of
ruin artists.
Yeah. Mm. Speaking of interesting characters, the opposite end of the spectrum of likability, Billy, that it turns out. Before a lot of the stuff came out about Chuck Berry, he did a runner on you, didn't he?
Oh, yeah.
Did you learn a lot that night?
Yeah, he was one of my first.
Late 70s, so early in your career?
Yeah, well, I learned. I really...
Did you learn about contract law?
Did you
learn about contract law? That's right. I think a lot of people learned not to trust Chuck Berry.
No, yeah. he was just a very bitter man, and he didn't like white people. He'd been very badly treated, to be fair to him, by white people most of his life.
Yeah.
And including white promoters.
Well, there's a lot of exploitation.
He had no respect for people in our industry.
Yeah.
And he just decided he wanted to bugger off and go home, so he did. And he had one more show to play.
Yeah.
So that didn't happen. But, that was in the good old days when Cliff Trillo and I were doing cabaret shows at Trillo's in Auckland.
Yeah.
We'd play two shows a night, at 6 o'clock and a 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
And we'd feed 1,000 people, do the show, send them home, do it again.
Do you want the steak or the chicken?
They were good days.
And so how far did you get? Did you get to the airport?
I got to the airport. I followed him out. One of the crew told me he'd gone.
Yeah.
Because one of his conditions, he always wanted to have his own car.
Mm.
And so he took off, and I followed him out and tried to stop him at the gate. And,
right.
I put my hand on his shoulder to stop him. There was a cop nearby.
Oh, boy.
He wasn't looking good. So he took a swing at me, and I sort of tried to pull him back, but it was futile. It was futile, yeah. And he's a big guy too.
Yeah.
He was a big man.
So where's the rest of his entourage and his band? He left them here to get home on their...
Yeah. Right. Well, they were playing a double bill with that lovely man, Bo Diddley.
Yeah.
And he was
good,
using...
Good cop, bad cop.
He was using Bo's band.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So it was just him on his own this night.
Okay.
Oh, and he was also using a couple of New Zealand musicians too. Jimmy Hill was one of them.
Because I was going to say I'm going to dwell on that, but I was just thinking, you know, if it's like, oh, you know, if the white man promoter, if it had been his band and stuff, that's pretty yeah, poor no, treatment on his part of everyone else, you know. He's very lucky that they had a plane heading his way. It could have been, oh, the next flight leaves on Thursday.
He worked it out.
Oh, okay, he'd made the phone calls in the hotel room and stuff.
New Zealand left at 11 p.m. and he had to be on that flight.
Yeah.
It was just, you know. But, you know, the other thing we learn in our business is that you can get to dislike an artist for many reasons.
Yeah.
But 9 times out of 10, you see them on stage doing their thing and you forgive them.
Yeah.
Because that's what they do.
So was the first show good?
Yeah. Oh, he was brilliant.
Oh, excellent. Here we go.
He always was.
Yeah.
Always was.
Yeah.
He always gave it, you know, everything. Mm.
That's right. I mean, obviously, often genius isn't even killed, is it? I just thought in the last, it's been fascinating, in the last few minutes, I did a bit of reading about you, as one would, before someone comes over to chat, and I didn't realise you'd got so involved in agitating about something that's, it just bugged me from afar for a while, like why suddenly there's double price or triple price tickets or whatever. And
tell me about it.
And to be clear to I mean, I'm sure everyone knows about this more so than the history of Radio Hierarchy. Yeah. It's the way I understand it is it's just some third party making money for Jam, isn't it?
Yeah. It's well, in some cases it's out and out fraud. With Vera Gogo and some
fake
of these,
tickets.
The Swiss company, that's a Swiss company that's at the head of this thing. They're the worst offender.
Fraud in terms of fake tickets?
They're basically inventing tickets.
Oh, man.
And selling them to people thinking they're buying them from the legitimate outlet, and they're not, paying a huge price for them, and turning up and finding that either the seats don't exist or they're held by somebody else.
So I mean, so you're probably going to like go if I had a dollar for every time I've been asked for this. But how come it hasn't been stopped? I mean, they're not like they're operating out of Nigeria or something. So how come? Yeah.
As we speak, they're being prosecuted in several countries around the world.
Right.
The word has got out, but it takes a long time to get governments on side to legislate against villains like this. And in saying that about Vera Gogo, not everything they do is a counterfeit ticket. Some of it's legitimate. They will actually go and buy.
That's sort of clever on their part. They're mixing up out and out fraud with. Right.
And so they've got enough legitimate tickets to make their operation look legitimate.
Right.
But all they're doing is profiteering at our expense and at the public's expense. And bad mistakes are made and people aren't getting to see the show.
Yeah, and also, good. Like I'm sure you've heard a lot before, and part of the reason, as well as ethics for customers, is that people often would think it's you guys that, you know, are part of this.
Well, a lot of people think it is us.
Because a lot of people don't know anything about the industry or behind the scenes. It's just, I bought a ticket, this thing will happen, you know.
And sadly, in some countries, not New Zealand, some promoters in my field do make a deal with the Vera Gogo of this world.
Yeah.
Sadly, it's got a bit closer to home now where our biggest ticket seller...
Is this Ticketmaster Resale?
Ticketmaster.
I don't even know what it is.
Is in the same business
what's Ticketmaster,
as well.
What's Ticketmaster... They're not selling fake tickets, are they?
No.
But what's Ticketmaster Resale?
But they're getting manifest from somewhere.
What is manifest?
Well, they're taking tickets out of the lot that are there to be sold to the public genuinely, first in, first served, same old story.
Yeah.
Somehow some tickets are moving from that block of tickets that the promoter has authorised them to sell, and they're moving out to outside people who say, oh, we've bought these tickets, we can't go to the show, we're reselling them.
So if it were my words, not yours, it would sound like... Ticketmaster's selling the tickets to Ticketmaster, who are then selling them back to Ticketmaster.
Well, we have no proof of that, but we know that the tickets are moving from that block of authorised tickets to someone through Ticketmaster's outlets.
And then Ticketmaster, through the thingy
majiggy, they say, well, we will sell them, we will resell them on our resale site.
And then so the promoter gets their agreed amount of money, which was part of the ticket price, and then suddenly the same company brand, Ticketmaster, is selling them for more again on the...
That's right.
And is this...
And then they split that profit with whoever the agent is that they've gotten involved.
Right. I'm getting annoyed, and I'm just not even...
There's so many people now are buying these tickets and then finding... The other trick, very good at this, they will buy a $99 ticket and sell it for $460, purporting it to be four rows from the front.
Yeah.
When it's really in the grandstand at the back of the...
Well, that's just out and out deception. Yeah, it's out and out deception. Yeah. The huge difference between those.
Which has created a grey area for Ticketmaster.
Yeah.
And we're all saying as an industry, look, just get out of this business. If you want to sell our tickets, get out of this resale business, because you're not making any friends with the industry.
No.
And sooner or later, these legislators are going to come along and stop you.
Yeah.
But they don't want to listen.
Well, they're making so much free money.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah. I had something else to ask about that. Oh, that's right. I've been aware of this for a while, what you're talking about, and then I learnt more about it the other day when I read some of the your commentary on it. But prior to that, I thought it was just a phenomenon of online. But is this directly related to why shows sell out in 10 seconds? I've never understood that, how things sell out that quickly these days.
To be quite honest, the promoter might not even know how his show sold out in 10 seconds because of this resale business.
Yeah.
Because
I don't understand if we had five laptops, I don't understand how the buying public can do that. It doesn't make sense for the numbers that are being...
Well, the vagaries of computer ticketing are such that with these massive servers they've got, I know it is physically possible to sell out a show very, very quickly.
Sure. Yeah.
Because you've got online coming into these massive servers and they process it immediately.
Sure.
So...
And these days...
Yes, it does happen.
Yeah.
But what we never know as promoters, we never get a stock sheet saying, here's who bought your tickets.
Yeah.
They won't tell us.
No.
So we don't know if they could have been selling a third of the house outside.
Yeah. Well, that's convenient. You don't get any data.
We get a certain amount of data, but we don't. Yeah. We don't know who bought the tickets.
And I won't dwell on this too much. I do have a couple more questions about it. Comments, whatever they'll be. Because before all of this came about, I used to get annoyed that people would openly scalp on TradeMe, which is sort of a level down numbers-wise. But I'd go, how can it be that this can happen? Yeah. So my logical response, my idea was, well, why doesn't TradeMe just have a rule that you can't sell a ticket for more than the face value? Would something like that be that simple a solution, or am I being naive?
Some of the legislation that's coming in through other countries, and I think Canada and Belgium are two of them, is stating that no reseller, including your TradeMe's, can resell a ticket for more than 10% of its face value.
That would seem to be the solution.
10% on top, which is fair,
because
there's handling fees and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And the guy gets his money back, TradeMe makes a small amount to cover its costs.
Yeah.
That's how it should be. But again, it gets back to legislation.
Yeah.
You've got to get ministers of government who believe in this fraud enough to put a limit on it and say, okay, boys, from now on, 1st of April, 10%, that's it.
I see. And now you get me thinking about it. Unfortunately for them, it's not a hot political item, is it? It's sort of...
Well, it's developing in New Zealand. Since the new minister came into power, he's taken a much greater interest in it. Australia's very hot on it. Victoria in particular in Australia are into heavy legislation as we speak. I think we will get some progress.
You know, I was just thinking... Yeah, oh, sorry, I wasn't meaning to be... meaning to be pessimistic. I was just thinking that as that came out of my mouth, I was thinking, well, actually, wider New Zealand pins a lot on sports, so I presume it's happening with rugby games and stuff as well, so that's probably a bigger selling point for government.
The irony of New Zealand is that the sporting organisations persuaded the government to pass a legislation to forbid reselling,
right?
But they didn't expand it to the entertainment industry.
Not dirty,
they
hippie
must have thought we were too much
industry.
White shoe people or something.
What is a white shoe person?
I don't know, but it only applies to major rugby and cricket matches, I think.
So it can be done.
So it is being practiced now, but it doesn't protect the whole entertainment industry, which it should. Because, you know, at the end of the day, our objection is simple. It's the punter that pays.
Yeah.
And it's the punter that's being ripped off.
Yeah.
And we don't like that.
No. Yeah, and it's not small amounts of money either. No. We have been chatting for 80 minutes, pretty much. Mm. And I thank you for coming in. It's been really enjoyable. I never know which way they'll go, and I was sort of looking at all the artists toured on and stuff, and then I thought of that great What Goes On Tour Stays On Tour, and I thought, yeah. I'll never get anything out of him. Just in closing.
Well, yeah, that's true.
Just in closing, Ian, you know, you are in semi-retirement. What are you busying yourself with now? I think you said you were
apart from running
with the boats the other day.
Helping run the next Hollies tour.
The what tour? Oh, New Hollies tour, yeah. Yep.
We've got the Hollies in February, March, and I might add it's selling very well.
Yeah.
Nothing much, really. I love living in Devonport.
Yeah.
And my wife spent much of her time in Australia, so we get across there a bit. We like to travel, yeah. Just like many people of our age. We live a pretty enjoyable life.
The same wife from the 70s when you were thinking about your career change?
No. My first wife sadly died in 1984.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
And I remarried
yeah.
a few years after that. And but no, it's a good life, and it's a great country to live in.
Well, that's a lovely place to end. Thank you.
Yeah.
We'll send you back over to Devonport on the train now.
Yes, off onto the train.
Thanks, mate.